This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Dyslexia affects 1 in 5 people, and it's often seen as a hidden disability. Today's guests say it can also be a hidden source of great abilities and frequently unrecognized powers. Our governor, Daniel Malloy, would agree. Malloy hasn't been shy about his struggles with learning disabilities and about how dyslexia has affected his life. We spoke with him earlier in the week about his experience.
I was born with dyslexia and other perceptual and processing disabilities. And you have to overcome them. And the way you overcome them is not that you ever are not a dyslexic anymore or that you do away with any other difficulties you might have been born with, but you have to develop compensatory skills to get around the problems that you were born with. In my case, you know, I'm the youngest of 8. A number of my siblings had similar difficulties. No one had them as severe as I did, and no one had any physical impairments. I was born with some physical impairments as well that I had to overcome. So, you know, having said all of that, you do the best you can. You get up every day. It's a frustrating experience. It can be defeating, and is for many people. But I think in many ways, it is part of what made me who I am.
When you were in grade school, middle school, and high school, dyslexia wasn't something that people talked about as much, though. So I'm wondering if you can talk maybe to some of the parents out there who are dealing with dyslexic kids right now, maybe you can talk about what it was like for you in school during a time at which this was not something that was as commonly talked about as it is today.
Yeah, well, school was miserable. You know, I was thought to be mentally retarded as late as the 4th grade. My physical impairments included the fact that I couldn't button a shirt or tie a shoe until I was in 5th grade. So it was a fairly miserable experience, quite frankly. What I tell parents, and so let me get right to it because I speak to a lot of parents of children with learning disabilities. Number one, raise a child who likes themselves, who's happy, and makes other people happy. There are relatively few truly likable and nice people who aren't successful in life in some way or another. Fight for your child. Make sure that they get all the help they need. But they don't need any more pressure from you, parents. They need support. They need love. They need understanding. But they do need the school support, whether that's in class, out of class, after school, before school, summer school. They need the support to develop what I already spoke about, which are the compensatory skills necessary to get around the difficulties. Listen, I began by saying that I think in part I am who I am because I was born with these disabilities. One of the reasons I became a pretty successful trial attorney, I suppose, was that I had developed pretty good memory and recall. Rather than concentrating on written language, I concentrated on oral language and communication. Those were compensatory skills that I was using to get around my difficulties. I'm 58 years old, probably one of the few kids whose mother ever bought them a big box radio to put beside their bed so I could listen to nighttime talk radio as I was going to sleep as a child. And she wanted me to develop a vocabulary. She wanted me to understand the art of argument. I'll go back to the point I made about being a nice person. My mother insisted that I be involved in community. She would literally drive me to nursing homes and tell me to get out of the car and go visit people who were being treated or stranded, if you will, in those days in nursing homes. So you do the best you can. You fight for your child. You don't put more pressure on them. You support them. You love them. And you do everything you can to make sure that they're nice people.
For people who don't struggle with dyslexia or people who don't understand the disorder at all, there are a lot of misperceptions. People hear dyslexia and they say, well, it's people who see words backwards or they see number systems backwards. Could you explain for people maybe your perceptions of letters and number systems so that they understand a bit more about what you've dealt with?
You know, I was a miserable reader until college, really. In fact, when I went away to college, I was still listening to most of my books, novels and textbooks on recorded books for the blind. And I did that through with the first semester of my sophomore year. Around high school, things started to get better. Things started to click for me. And by the time that I had finished my first semester sophomore year, I was humming along pretty well at that point. I don't know what I saw backwards or didn't see backwards. I know that I was a miserable reader. I know that I couldn't decipher written language. I still really can't write well, and I suppose to some extent I can explain it this way. Most people, if you tell them to write a sentence, they'll just write it right out. I have to stop and analyze every word and recall to the best I can how that word is spelled and how it's put together. It's a very mechanical as opposed to a fluid movement, and I suppose that's the best way. You know, people decipher what your problem is. They tell you you're reversing letters, but you have no knowledge that you're reversing letters when you're doing it, if that's part of your particular case.
Last thing for you. When you talk about compensatory skills, it's hard for a lot of kids because, you know, kids don't necessarily want to be seen as different. They want to be like the other kids. And in some ways, and we've heard this from educators and we've heard this from parents a lot, schools almost want kids to be the same. They want them in some ways to be little robots, all taking the test the same way, doing things. Talk a little bit more about how you think schools can do a better job in allowing for children who have learning disabilities to establish those compensatory skills, to learn differently in a classroom where sameness is sometimes very important.
Yeah, well, I suppose that's the case. I think that systems are starting to do a better job. They're teaching in our colleges and universities that produce teachers more about learning disabilities or differences. And so I think teachers are coming out of college more open to the concept of individualized instruction. You want everybody to get the big themes, but how they get those are different in a classroom. And so the best teachers are those teachers that can teach differently the same theme. So I think it's gotten easier to some extent. I think there's more knowledge about learning disabilities, dyslexia, and others, because I think there's a group of things that need to be talked about. But you need teachers and you need systems that are going to overcome the propensity that you just talked about, the sameness. Children are not the same. There are very distinct differences. Some of it may be along racial lines or their family backgrounds or how they learn or how they can't learn. Those schools, those teachers that are willing to go the extra mile are actually rewarded with some pretty good results.
Governor Dana Malloy, thank you so much for talking to us about this.
Sure. Thank you.
Governor Malloy talked to us on Tuesday. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. And today we're talking about the reading disorder dyslexia. We'd like you to join us with your stories. If you're dyslexic or your child is, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org or tweet us at wherewelive. Joining us from the studios at Yale University in New Haven are Dr. Sally Shaywitz, the Audrey Ratner Professor in Learning Development at Yale, co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, author of Overcoming Dyslexia. Dr. Sally Shaywitz, welcome back to our show. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
Joining her as well in the studio is Dr. Bennett Shaywitz, Charles and Helen Schwab Professor in Dyslexia and Learning Development, Chief of Pediatric Neurology and co-director of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. Thank you, sir, for joining us as well.
It's a pleasure.
First of all, I'd like to get your reactions to Governor Malloy and the way he described his experiences growing up and continuing to cope with dyslexia. How much of what he said is common to many others in America today?
I don't think you could have gotten a better description. Congratulations to Governor Malloy for capturing the essence of dyslexia so well. And what Governor Malloy did is capture what we know about dyslexia. Dyslexia is basically an unexpected difficulty in reading. So that people who are dyslexic have two parts to them. There's a weakness in getting to the sounds of spoken words, which then make reading problematic. But there is also strength. We call it a sea of strengths model. So you have a weakness, and then you have strengths and actually in higher level thinking processes, reasoning, critical thinking, problem solving, the ability to see the big picture. So you have these two parts, and it's very much a paradox. So it becomes important, and this is what Governor Malloy's mother tried to instill in him by what she provided. You have the weakness and you have the strength. So it's up to us as a society, parents, educators, policymakers, to make sure that a child's life is defined by those high thinking abilities and excellent reasoning and not by his or her slow reading and poor spelling.
And I'm wondering, Dr. Benachiewicz, if you can pick up on that a bit, this idea that Governor Malloy continually talked about these compensatory skills. Essentially, what I'm hearing is that there are these strengths. Maybe you can talk about what some of these strengths are specifically.
I think I'm going to take that
that's
one,
fine.
John. I think the strengths are the ability to see the big picture, to think in broader ways. Charles Schwab, in a film that we've made, says he has the ability to see the end zone while other people are still thinking bit by bit by bit. And sometimes that makes people uncomfortable because they say, well, how did you get there? So that people have these wonderful thinking abilities. But I think we would be remiss this morning if we didn't point out that science has brought us a long way to understanding the nature of the difficulties in dyslexia and the importance of identifying children. And now we have, just as we have in medicine, we have evidence-based interventions that science have shown work and make a difference. So it becomes very, very important. This wasn't available when Governor Malloy was a child, for schools to be knowledgeable about dyslexia, to identify children who are dyslexic, and to provide them with the types of instruction and accommodations that will make sure that their lives are in a path that the strengths characterize their lives. And one other thing I should mention, because we talk about learning disability, learning differences, etc., dyslexia is by far and away the most common learning disability, affecting about 85% of all children who are identified as having a learning disability. So while it's not the only one, it's by far and away the most common one, and it's also universal. It occurs in every society, in every racial group, in every ethnic group. As you mentioned, I wrote a book, Overcoming Dyslexia, and to my surprise, that book has not only been translated into the usual alphabetic languages, but also to Japanese, Chinese, Korean. So it affects everybody, it's persistent, and it doesn't go away.
And we'll be talking in just a moment about what the science does tell us about dyslexia today, what we've learned about it. And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We do have people who want to join this conversation, though, especially after hearing from Governor Malloy and his description. I want to get a quick word from Cassidy, who's in Glastonbury. Hello, Cassidy. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I'm 15, and I wanted to talk to you about I've had dyslexia since I was a child. And starting in kindergarten, the teachers were just saying that I was slow, that I was going to catch up, and no one wanted to acknowledge that I had dyslexia and that I had learning problems. So throughout school, school's not equipped for dealing with dyslexia. So my mom had to give me outside help. I had to go to the Dyslexia Institute of Technology of America. And for years, I went twice a week for hours I worked. And dyslexia has gotten better. And actually, now I'm in high school, and I'm at a much higher reading level than 10th grade. I'm at a senior reading level. So with outside help, you can definitely, I call it, overcome dyslexia, but I still have issues. My family calls it global dyslexia, where it's not just reading things upside down and having writing and reading levels. It's also left and right and direction, and it also affects my body. So I'm learning to cope with that. But I think that the school system should really focus on dyslexia and not just tell the parents that their child is slow. That they should really work on helping the kids so they can overcome as much as they can.
Cassidy, thank you very much for sharing your story. I truly appreciate it, and I'm glad that the programs that you've taken part in have given you some help. I really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Thanks.
I'd like to comment on what Cassidy said, if I might.
Please, absolutely.
I think Cassidy made such an important point. For too many children in our country, in our state, in our communities, school begins after school, because schools don't address, don't acknowledge, and don't provide effective interventions for children who are intelligent, who want to learn. And those children, many of those, if their parents have the resources, go to tutoring, go to after-school programs. So their school begins at 4 o'clock. And the tragedy of all this is magnified for disadvantaged children, children of color, children of Latino heritage, whose parents may not have those resources to provide a second school, if you will. And that's why the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity has begun what we call the Multicultural Dyslexia Awareness Initiative, where we're trying to bring awareness of dyslexia to populations of color, to children and families of Latino heritage, because those children are affected but are very rarely identified, when identification could put them on the path to self-awareness, to success in school, and to a hopeful life.
And we're going to be talking more about the Multicultural Dyslexia Awareness Initiative in just a bit here on our program. I do want to learn a bit more about what exactly is happening in the brain, and maybe you can walk us through that, Dr. Bennett-Shaywitz. What is happening in the brain of a dyslexic person that might be different than someone else?
Well, that's a very good question. And over the last two decades, brain science has really made great strides in understanding what is happening in the brain as children with dyslexia read. We've made these great strides because of the emergence of a very remarkable technology called functional magnetic resonance imaging, which allows us to actually see the brain at work. We ask children to read while they're being imaged, and we can see which parts of the brain are most active and which parts of the brain are not as active during the process of reading. And what we found, brain imaging has really taught us a great deal about dyslexia. And what we've learned is that there's a neural signature for dyslexia. And that signature is an inefficient functioning of certain systems in the brain, particularly those systems for skilled or fluent reading. And what is so important is that brain imaging has made visible what has previously been a hidden disability. And that is really important, because if a child has a broken arm, for example, he can bring an X-ray in and say, look, I have a broken arm. But up to now, children with dyslexia couldn't see that there was a hidden disability. I have a very important caution. One is that the brain imaging is very helpful in telling us about the neural signature in groups of people with dyslexia compared to groups of people who are typical readers. It's not sensitive enough to use as a diagnostic tool to tell us in any individual case. And while I'm providing that warning, I'm also want to tell people that while dyslexia is familial, we've learned that over the last 100 years, we've also been very disappointed in the fact that we've not been able to identify any single gene or groups of genes that will accurately identify people who are with dyslexia. It turns out that a complicated process like reading and dyslexia has many, many, many genes involved, each explaining a small amount of the problem. And so there's no single group of genes or single gene that will tell us this is the gene for dyslexia. Just want to give that warning.
And I think that's a very important point. The more that we talk in this state, certainly, about genomic medicine, the ability to isolate a particular dyslexia gene would be a breakthrough, certainly, but you're saying that that's not something that you found. I wanted to get to this idea of the functional MRI and what it is you're seeing when you're tracking someone reading, sure, who has dyslexia. Are there different parts of the brain that light up, that fire off when you're reading versus writing? Is the deficiency in the way these parts of the brain connect? Maybe you can just explain that a bit further, sir.
So what it is there are differences. It turns out that there are major systems for reading, and they paralleled systems for speaking, and they're on the left side of the brain. There are three important systems. There's a system in the front of the brain and two systems in the back of the brain that are very important for reading. And what happens in groups of people with dyslexia is those systems in the back of the brain are functioning inefficiently. One of those systems is very critical for skilled, fluent reading. That's been very well documented. And so so these systems are functioning inefficiently, and you can actually see that in, as I emphasize, in groups of people. Now, what's been learned now, and this, the science has advanced to the point that we not only can say that there's an inefficient functioning, but we're starting to be able to say the way these systems are connected and the way to other systems in the brain is very different in dyslexic individuals compared to typical readers. So the brain science has advanced to where people are starting to look at the way these systems are connected. And it is very different in dyslexia compared to typical readers.
I want to get to one more quick phone call before our break. Dorothea is calling from Montauk, New York. Hi there. You're on Where We Live. Hi, Dorothea. Are you there?
Yes. Hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. What's on your mind?
My son, Timothy, has dyslexia, and I was lucky enough that it was diagnosed when he was only in kindergarten. He had a speech delay, which, he had outside speech therapy from the time he was about two. And from working with him with his speech therapist and then having to do the work that I did on my own with him, when he was in kindergarten, I really knew that something else was wrong with him. He wasn't catching on to the alphabet, couldn't do the days of the week. And, you know, being in a public school, they would never let you use the term dyslexia. They will say, oh, yeah, he needs some support, but he's too young. If we feel he needs to be evaluated, we'll do some evaluation. But right now, just let's give him some support. And, you know, I waited, and the school wasn't stepping up to do their part to help my son. And a five-year-old coming home saying, I'm stupid, Mommy, is not a healthy thing to continue. I went to the school, tried to bring it to their attention that Timothy needed to be evaluated. They took their time, and so I went privately and had my son evaluated through a neuropsych, and he was able to come up with the diagnosis of dyslexia. But unfortunately, the schools, public schools and the teachers, are not allowed to use these kind of medical terms, dyslexia, ADD, even if they have a suspicion it's going on with your child.
Well, and one thing, what I'd like to do is get a quick comment from Sally Shaywitz about this. And Dorothea, thank you so much. We've spent some time in the program recently talking about learning disabilities in schools and how schools cope with this. Sally Shaywitz, what Dorothea is talking about is sometimes the reluctance of schools to try to diagnose something like dyslexia, but also just to talk openly about it for fear that they might have to provide certain services.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. Sadly, Dorothea is explaining a situation that's sadly not unusual. We at our Yale Center, and I and Bennett personally, hear from far too many parents where the school will not use the word, will not identify, and then will withhold treatment. I mean, we believe that this is a civil rights issue. If children have the ability to learn, and schools should have the ability to teach those children to learn, and they withhold that, that's influencing their entire lives. That's putting them on a path to failure, to lack of success. Whereas we have stories of exceptions where children were identified, where they received effective interventions, where they received accommodations, and they soared. We have Nobel laureates. We have, you talk about attorneys, David Boies, the attorney, Toby Cosgrove, who's probably the finest cardiac surgeon in the country and now CEO of the Cleveland Clinic, the writer John Irving. So a child's life, he's at a crossroads. He can go either way. And schools have that responsibility to ensure that they're learning. It's not a trivial thing. This is a child's life. And remember, children only have one life. Mm-hmm. And schools tend to delay and delay and delay. And I want to mention one other thing. You know, they say, well, it costs so much money to provide special ed. It costs more in the life of a child and the loss to society of what that child can provide by not doing it. We're supposed to be a smart country who believes in investing in the future. The best investment our country can make is investing in our children and being able to identify and effectively treat the most common learning disability. You know, 1 in 5, that's a lot.
I just want to take a quick break because we're going to hear from some more people who have been affected by dyslexia in their lives. I'll tell our audience that we're talking with Dr. Sally Shaywitz and Dr. Bennett Shaywitz from the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. We're going to talk about a new initiative at Yale working to highlight the learning disability in minority communities where it's often underdiagnosed. We're going to take more of your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about dyslexia with Dr. Sally and Bennett Shaywitz from the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. They join us from the Yale Studios in New Haven. Now, earlier this month, they held a conference to launch a multicultural dyslexia awareness initiative to highlight the fact that the learning disability crosses racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic lines, and it can be underdiagnosed in minority populations. Dr. Sally Shaywitz talked about this a bit earlier. I want to bring in Reverend Keith McGee, who's overseeing this initiative. He's dyslexic himself, and he joins us by phone today. Reverend, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be able to join you all.
I'm wondering if you can tell us first a bit about your experience with dyslexia.
Well, I was diagnosed in the Bayou of Louisiana when I was in the second grade by a teacher who had attended a historically black college and had taken a course that had made her somewhat familiar with dyslexia and realized because of what had appeared to be my acting out in the class, that what was actually the challenge was that I was dyslexic. And so she invested personal time and energy in me around reading, and that is what really has made the difference in my life. It was taking the time and the patience with me to learn how to read. It's really, you know, what Sally Shaywitz says is that, you know, this is an unexpected difficulty in learning to read. And so learning to read helped me get over the barrier and to better navigate life with dyslexia.
Could you talk a bit about your involvement with this Multicultural Dyslexia Awareness Initiative? What is it you're hoping to accomplish here?
Well, what we're collectively hoping to accomplish is to bring about awareness and advocacy within communities of color. As we have launched at Yale, we're talking about dyslexia and the achievement gap as a civil rights issue of our time. How do we highlight this with advocacy, awareness, and education that students of color, and all children for that matter, can be accommodated so that they can overcome and navigate the system? Though we have this learning difference.
Sally Shaywitz, why is this being underdiagnosed in, say, the African-American community?
Well, that's a really good question. I think part of it is lack of awareness and people thinking about it, that this may be it. And I think, sad to say, often is the lack of higher expectations. We have had the privilege of actually working with the charter school system serving disadvantaged children and have been impressed by the intelligence and the motivation, the desire to read among the children who may be disadvantaged or of color or of Latino heritage. And if you look at the achievement gap, which means that there is a big difference in the graduation rates, for example, between children who are white and children who may be either African American or Latino, we believe that dyslexia and the failure to identify it and treat it is a major factor explaining that achievement gap. And this becomes really important because at the rate we're going, we will not close that achievement gap for 40 years. Now, No child can wait that long. We need to act. And we're so delighted to be working with Reverend McGee and others, and to really bring awareness, but also to bring action. What happens in so many areas of we're physicians of medicine, we say, we need more knowledge. There's a knowledge gap. And in the case of dyslexia, of course, it would be nice to have some more knowledge, but we have enough knowledge to act better. What we have in the case of dyslexia is an action gap. We need to act. We need to act at every level. We need to act as individuals to support children with dyslexic. We need educators to diagnose, identify, and provide evidence-based interventions. And we need our policymakers to make sure the policy addresses the needs of the 10 million or more children who are dyslexic.
And Bennett Shaywitz, quickly, I'm just wondering if you could chime in here. Does science tell us anything about differences along racial lines when it comes to dyslexia?
There's no evidence that there's any difference in any of the in any neurobiologic measures or any of the genetic measures or any way of the in racial differences. We expect dyslexia to be as common in the African-American and Latino population as it is in the populations, other populations that have been studied. So there's no what Sally and I would say is dyslexia is an equal opportunity disability.
So, Keith McGee, before I let you go, talk about what you're doing to fill this action gap, as Sally Shaywitz puts it, this need to take some action here. What are you doing?
So what we've done since our launch at Yale, August 4th and 5th, where we gave out-of-the-box thinkers awards to two dyslexics, Harry Belafonte and Maggie Prokock, who is from England, we're now taking that dyslexia and the achievement gap, the civil rights issue of our time, on the road to do national town hall meetings. So we will have our first meeting in Washington, D.C. during the Congressional Black Caucus's annual legislative conference. And from there, we go to Atlanta, Georgia, Cleveland, Ohio, Dallas, Texas, and to the San Francisco Bay Area to have town hall meetings to make people aware and to get them informed so that we can get some action from the ground.
Reverend Keith McGee, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate your help and your work.
You're welcome. Thank you all.
If you want to join us as we talk about dyslexia on the program today, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Let's go to David, who's calling from Hartford. Hi, David. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. Good to talk with you. I'm glad you're having the program. I'm just calling because I think especially the idea of lowered expectations applies to girls. My sister is severely dyslexic and was told by her first grade teacher that she would, quote, make someone a very nice wife. And she ultimately, through a huge amount of patience within our family and an extraordinary amount of hard work on her part, graduated high school as a valedictorian and then went on to study at Duke University, and is now a professional physical therapist. So I just think girls especially, I would urge all parents, do not accept anything less than you would for any other child. Every child has such unique gifts, and I hopefully this sort of stereotype is less than it was 40 years ago when she went through it.
Well, David, thank you so much for sharing that story. I truly appreciate it.
I'd like to comment on that. For many years, it used to be thought that dyslexia only affected boys. So boys were the only ones identified and the only ones who received any type of support. In the early 1990s, I direct a study called the Connecticut Longitudinal Study, which is basically a population-based survey of Connecticut school children. And we tested everyone. And we found that there might be a few more boys, but basically equal numbers of boys and girls. So that it becomes really important. I'm so glad that this gentleman brought up this issue. Girls can be affected and are affected and must be identified as well as boys. I want to also address something your previous caller said, who spoke about her son having language difficulties, and that led to his identification. And that's important because we know now that dyslexia isn't an issue of seeing letters or reading words backwards. It's an issue of a difficulty getting to the basic sounds of spoken words, to be able to identify and pull apart a spoken word into its individual sounds. So the word mat would be m-a-t, because that's the way you can connect a letter to its sound and sound out a word. And the importance of this is because it affects spoken language, you can identify children at risk even early on before they're expected to read. That's really important. And it's also important that dyslexia doesn't only affect reading. It affects spoken language. Early on, there might be delayed speech. Later on, difficulties with word retrieval. A person knows what they want to say, but the wrong word comes out. And we understand why now. It's not a problem with thinking. It's a problem with actually uttering the sounds that make up the word. So we've learned a great deal. So knowing that the difficulty is getting to the sounds of spoken words allows us to understand what the symptoms are, difficulties with spoken language, difficulties with reading, difficulties with spelling, difficulties with learning a second language. At Yale University, I'm very proud to say that we have quite a large number of very competent, very successful dyslexic students, and they may apply for a partial waiver of their foreign language requirement. And we've now done a study, and we're in the midst of analyzing it, of Yale students who are dyslexic, looking at them 5 years or more after graduation, and they do incredibly well. So it's important for people to be aware of that.
I want to get to a few more phone calls because people do want to share some stories. Linda is in West Haven. Hi, Linda. Go ahead.
Thank you. Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I thought it was important to talk about a young boy who heard that I was a learning specialist. My husband was volunteering at a school for inner-city disturbed children. And it was an eighth-grade class, and a young boy ran up to me in front of his class, got on his knees, looked me in the eye, and said, "I beg you to teach me to read."
Mm.
And I did. I went in, and by the end of the school year, he had made enormous advances. And one of the reasons that I'm telling you this is because then he had to take a standardized test. And he was so severely depressed by the fact that it was so hard for him, because this, as beautifully as he had progressed, this let him know that it wasn't good enough. So I was very sad about that. And the other aspect of this story was that the teachers were not able to follow up and teach reading at this stage. And that was something that needs to be addressed, too, in the proper, whether it's Orton-Gillingham or whatever approaches you. So thank you for taking my call.
Well, Linda, thank you very much for sharing that story. And as we head to a break here, I'll just read a quick tweet from Real Hartford, who asks a question that a few people are asking us on Twitter today. How does all this fit in with the high-pressured standardized testing? Maybe when we come back, we can talk a bit more with our guests about this, about learning in the environment that schools are today if you have a disability like dyslexia. Dr. Sally Shaywitz, Dr. Bennett Shaywitz join us from Yale University today. You can join us as well, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, cable TV is at a crossroads. Two big channels just launched this month, Al Jazeera America and Fox Sports One. But meanwhile, Netflix is blowing up the old cable model by bypassing the cable bundle and bringing original content straight to viewers. We'll also look at the role of ESPN, the behemoth Connecticut company that might just hold the future of cable in its hands. You can join the conversation about television on your radio on Mondays, Where We Live. Today in the program, we're talking about dyslexia with two experts in the field. Dr. Sally Shaywitz and Dr. Bennett Shaywitz are co-directors of the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. They join us from the Yale studios in New Haven. We're talking with a number of people. Want to join us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Let's go to Amy, who's calling from Newtown. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. The reason I was calling is because I always hear dyslexia referred to as a reading disorder, and I wondered if there's anything similar to dyslexia with regard to numbers, because I've always had difficulty transposing lists of numbers or numbers that are longer than three digits without reversing the centers of them. And all through school, my parents were always told that your daughter has a very high IQ, but she's so careless she can't do her math. Yet I understand conceptually the math, and so I was curious about that because I also can't spell, and I've never been able to learn right from left. So I was just wondering if that's a variant of this or if it's an entirely different issue.
Amy, thank you so much for your question.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. There's a lot known about dyslexia, but not as much known about problems with numbers. And probably because we just don't have a good conceptual framework to deal with what do we mean by having problems with numbers. Like the example that Slady was talking about, she conceptually knows much more about math than just reversing numbers. And that's true. One of the there are many, many famous scientists who are very good at who have talked about being very good at high-level math and yet being very poor at doing simple calculations. So I think from that perspective, there's just not as much known. It's well described that there are people who have problems with what's called dyscalculia, difficulty calculating. In dyslexia, we do know that spelling problems are in fact one of the major symptoms, and there are many people that we see with dyslexia who've told us that they've had difficulty with right-left confusion. They have difficulty with directionality. They get lost very frequently. It's not as well described as a population of dyslexics, but many individuals with dyslexia have told us that. And we just don't understand what the problem, why that should be.
I want to quickly get to Barry, who's calling from Ridgefield. Hello, Barry.
Yes.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm on the board with Sal, and I want to congratulate her and thank her for all the work she does. I just want to comment that as an adult dyslexic, I was diagnosed at age 47. I spent 17 years as a curriculum casualty, which Sally knows. But by accident, I had to take dancing lessons from my grandfather in ballroom dancing for 9 years. And as in retrospect, it was a wonderful piece of remediation. I'd like her to speak to that.
Oh, excellent. Barry, thank you so much for sharing that. Sally, you want to jump in?
Well, I know Barry, and I admire him. And he has a wonderful, I think it's called the Firehouse Station in Reading or Richfield that features the music and singing. It may be that working with his grandfather close and having support provided him with some degree of self-confidence that's often lacking when you've failed at so many things. But can I give you a scientific explanation? I cannot.
there is the systems for music and the systems for reading seem to be very different in the brain, and yet there may be some link between the two, but that isn't very well characterized at the moment.
I want to mention something very important, and that is people who are dyslexic, even those who've had remediation, will be able to learn how to read accurately, but they're not going to read automatically. Those are because of those systems working inefficiently in the back of the brain. They're going to be slow readers, not slow thinkers, but slow readers. And it's essential that those individuals be given extra time on standardized tests and even on classroom tests. And as I said, it's not an issue. People mistake, well, if you're a slow reader, maybe you're a slow thinker. And we at Yale have a wonderful head of our physician who's head of our emergency department, Dr. Karen Santucci. And she always says, I read slowly, but I think quickly. And it's important for people to pull, not to confuse those, because often teachers at school will say, oh, that child reads slowly. We have to put him in a lower level. It's thinking is high. It's just the slow process of reading. And the Americans with Disability Amendment Act says that students who have this difficulty should be given extra time on their high-stakes standardized tests. So it's important to realize their reading comprehension can be very high, but it won't show itself unless they've had that extra time on high-stakes standardized tests.
With just a few minutes left, I want to hear from Virginia, who's in New Haven. Hi, Virginia. Go ahead.
Yes. I happen to be a godmother of a young woman who's now about 28, who's African-American, and I'm white, and she's always had language problems, severe language problems, couldn't get a word out straight. And when she was in school, I would go to her PPPs and try and get her special services. But because her IQs did not test out that low, they wouldn't give her special services. And in fact, they accused me of being racist because I was, at the time, the only white person in the room. And they thought I was trying to get an African American into special ed and put them down for that reason.
Hmm. Well, Virginia, thank you for sharing that story. And Sally Shaywitz, I don't know if you just have a quick comment on that, because we want to get to at least one more phone call, but go ahead.
Well, I think it gives us even more reasons why this Multicultural Dyslexia Awareness Initiative is so necessary. African-American children, Latino children, they're no different than anybody else, but they're being treated differently. We thought we got rid of that years ago, but we haven't. Now it's in our schools, and we have to get rid of it there so children can have the bright futures they deserve.
I'm going to ask a question for Catherine in North Haven, just because we're running low on time. She wants to know if there's a relationship between dyslexia and stuttering.
Well, that's a really good question. I've been asked that a number of times. I haven't seen literature on it, but people who are dyslexic, because they have trouble getting to the sounds of words, they often have trouble uttering the word they want to say. So I wouldn't be surprised if in a subgroup of individuals there was an overlap between stuttering and dyslexia.
Bennett Shaywitz, can you say anything about that at all?
No, just to reinforce what Sally said, there's no medical or neuroscientific literature that links the two.
So in just the last minute or so that we have, if listeners who have not been able to get through with their phone calls have some concerns or some questions about themselves or their children, what's the best thing to do? You're at the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, but what's the first place they should go?
The first place they should go is they should is one thing is just as with Governor Malloy, mothers are often the champions of children. If you have a concern, you can speak to your pediatrician, but also go to your child's teacher. But don't take no for an answer. Be persistent. Speak to the head of special education. Speak to the person who's in charge of reading. Speak to the superintendent. Let your voice be heard. Find others in your community. Darianne has done that. And join together. Together, you're a force. And you can also contact our Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity, www.dyslexia.yale.edu.
Thank you both so much for joining me today. I really appreciate this conversation. Dr. Sally Shaywitz and Dr. Bennett Shaywitz joined us from the Yale Studios in New Haven. Thanks very much to intern Kristen Dorr. It's her last day today. Thank you for all your help. And thanks to producer Samaya Hernandez, who helped to put this show together before she left for a brand new job in the governor's office. Despite the fact that she's changed teams, we will miss her and wish her all the best. Good luck, Samaya. And please have a good weekend from all of us at Where We Live.